I am Plant on the Line. This is thecommentary.ca. Gwen Dyer has a new book out. It's an alarming book that foresees the catastrophic outcome should CO2 emissions rise and the climate increase. The book outlines fascinating and sometimes scary scenarios that see unrest and conflict, wars and natural disasters, rising sea levels and dwindling resources, political extremism and famine. More than providing an uncomfortable glimpse into the future, it also provides some hope what we can do now, and more importantly, what our leaders can do. The book is Climate Wars. It is published by Random House and retails for $34.95. Gwen Dyer is a freelance journalist and broadcaster, lecturer, and columnist who appears in more than 175 newspapers around the world. Locally, you can read him in the Georgia Strait. His website is gwendyer.com. He was on last for his book on Iraq, The Mess They Made. He's written other books, including War, Future Tense, and With Every Mistake. Please welcome once again to the Plant on the Line program, Gwen Dyer. Good morning, Dr. Dyer.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. Climate change seems to be an awfully fashionable book topic, but you certainly approached this book differently. Was there a sense to do it differently that you weren't, it's just so that you weren't hopping aboard this sort of subject?
Hopping aboard the subject is exactly what I was accused of by a leading environmentalist, whose name must remain concealed. But I do the strategic stuff, the wars, the international relations, all that. This is sort of my beat. And what led me in this book is that I realized the military, especially in the U.S., were hopping aboard this train, that they were beginning to do scenarios of climate change and coming up with situations that clearly would give them jobs to do, because there's a whole lot of political and economic and strategic fallout when the temperature starts going up. It's not just going to be hotter, it's also going to be areas that you can't grow food in anymore, and the government collapses and becomes a failed state because it can't feed its population. Half the population's trying to leave. And so there's pressure on all the borders and people trying to stop them from getting into the next door country that's still got some food. All that stuff becomes a military and strategic problem. It also becomes an obstacle to making any kind of global deal to get our emissions down. So it seemed to me a subject kind of worth exploring.
And it's not something like, the Iraq War. It's not something that they're wanting to fight. The upcoming problems that you foresee.
No, but I mean, let's just take the Middle East for a minute, and I'll give you two examples of how you can actually get real wars out of this. Iraq basically lives off the water that comes out the two rivers, the Tigris and the Euphrates, right? Mesopotamia.
Right.
Both of those rivers rise in eastern Turkey, not in Iraq. And the Turks are building a series of huge dams on them at the moment, mainly for generation of power, but if, as is very likely in a climate change scenario, that whole area of the Mediterranean starts drying out and there's a lot less rainfall than there used to be, the Turks do have these dams in place, and are they going to be generous and let all that water flow downstream to Iraq, or are they going to keep what they need and just let a little bit go downstream to Iraq? And how do the Iraqis deal with that one? Then you can make the same kind of argument for Egypt at the bottom of the Nile, and Sudan upstream, and Ethiopia even further upstream. And if the rainfall diminishes over the Ethiopian highlands, even if there are agreements in place, will those agreements hold when there's not enough water in the river, and if you stick with the old agreement, your people starve? So that sort of thing, multiplied by any number of other river basins, is part of the problem. You could get an India-Pakistan war out of that, because most of five of the six branches of the Indus River flow across India before they reach Pakistan, and that river is going to be empty in the summertime in 20 years. The glaciers are melting now that feed it in the summer, that keep it full in the summer. So that sort of thing, and whole areas where basically the rain doesn't fall anymore and the farms dry up and blow away. Central America, for example, gets very hard hit. Central America and Mexico. There's 200 million people there, and there's already a pretty steady flow of legal but mostly illegal immigrants from there into the United States. If that triples or quadruples in size because people are desperate, the Americans are going to have to do something about that border, very different from the way they treat it at the moment. It's pretty porous. They let a lot of people slide through, you know, because American farmers want cheap stoop labor. They pretend to keep it shut, but they don't try very hard. If you really had to shut it, Mexico would probably explode in 2 or 3 years, you know, if that safety valve was shut off. You know, and you'd have huge repercussions in the U.S. as well. You know, you can't shut a border, really shut it, without being willing to kill people who are trying to cross it. And if you start killing Mexicans trying to get into the United States, how does the 1/6 of the U.S. population who are of Mexican descent view that? You know?
Yeah.
These are discussions they're having in the Pentagon right now.
And do they see the same urgency that you see?
Yes, they do. I mean, the Pentagon is actually convinced internally, and I think this will go public pretty quickly once Mr. Bush is out of the way. The Pentagon is convinced that most of its next generation missions are going to be climate change related. That's their next meal ticket. You know, they're sick to death of the war on terror anyway. They wish that would go away, and they don't really believe in it. They never wanted to invade Iraq, you know. So, moving on from that, what's next on the agenda, and the Pentagon is clearly fixed on climate change as where they're going to be doing most of the work in the next generation.
And do you see much hope with the new administration, President Obama?
Well, President Obama is going to have quite a lot on his plate, is he not? You know, very inbox from hell. But I do think that he is pretty... He's certainly aware of the science and the economic implications of climate change. Whether the Pentagon has been able to get at him yet to draw his attention to the strategic implications, I couldn't say, because it can't do it publicly until Mr. Bush goes away. But I can tell you there's going to be a fat dossier about that on Obama's desk when he sits down in the Oval Office on the 20th of January. He will know about it.
You taught at Sandhurst, and you've written much about world conflict. Was it fun? Fun's the wrong word, but was it interesting or fascinating, even scary, to come up with the scenarios that you did in this book?
It was all of those things. But in most cases, I didn't actually come up with them myself. I borrowed them from the military, who are doing them in-house already. I mean, you know, you can be sure that the Pakistan military and the Indian military have climate change scenarios about what happens when there's not enough water in the Indus River. You know, that's what they do for a living. Of course they're doing that. So, you know, while I sort of rearrange the scenarios and combine some and so on, and these are not all stuff I just made up out of my head. This is what's being discussed in-house in various militaries around the planet. You know, some of it will surely happen because we are already committed to about another degree of heating, you know, 1 degree Celsius hotter, and that's enough to trigger some of this stuff. Please God, we're not committed to 2 or more degrees because we're not yet. There's a window here. We still have a little bit of wiggle room, though not nearly as much as I'd like. But these scenarios, some of them are going to come to pass. I mean, the Mexican border will be shut 10 years from now, for sure. And that will have huge repercussions both in Central America and in the United States itself. And the Pentagon knows that.
Yeah. Now, environmentalists and celebrities like to tell us that we need to save the planet. Your book is unique, and it's striking that you're saying that we need to save ourselves.
Well, of course. I mean, the planet will be all right. It was all right before we arrived. It'll be all right after we're gone if we go. It's a big organism, and it actually has a lot of different modes of climate in the past and potentially in the future, all of which it has survived. You know, we can push it to the point where it becomes inhospitable to human civilization long enough for human civilization to collapse. But, you know, you can't. We are still not in a position where we can completely ruin the biosphere. We are causing a sort of mass extinction event, but there's been others of those not caused by human beings, and we're, you know, the planet's still fine. It's us. It's our civilization, a world that will support 6 billion human beings. That's what's at risk.
But what should we do? Should we drive less? Should we change our light bulbs? Or it needs to be more?
By all means, do that. But that's Band-Aids. It's useful. If you're bleeding, you need a Band-Aid. No, we have to change the way we produce our energy. I mean, this problem will only be solved at source. So stop burning coal. Generate your electricity other ways. And there are other ways. There's solar. There's wind power. There's nuclear. I don't have a problem with nuclear. There's, you know, waves and tide and geothermal and all that stuff. The technologies are available. You don't have to go out and invent them. In the long run, you don't stop driving. I mean, let's be realistic. We're not going to stop driving. Maybe we drive less. The way we laid our cities out, we need cars. And, you know, that's a technology, that's a sort of built environment that you're not going to change until 40 years. But, you know, it's all right to drive your car if what you're fueling it with isn't oil that you pumped out of the earth, fossil fuel, which is, you know, not in the natural cycle. But if you can get oil from some sort of biofuel which is in the natural cycle, then you're taking the carbon dioxide out of the air when the plant grows or whatever, and you're putting it back in the air when you burn the fuel, that's neutral. You're not really causing a problem. Present generation of biofuels are a disaster, you know, getting it from corn, but then they weren't even designed to deal with climate change. This was all about so-called energy independence. It was a Bush initiative, basically, and it didn't have a single thing to do with climate change. Doesn't really address the issue, but there are technologies now being, basically they're in for the sort of scale them up to large scale stage. I mean, they've done it in the labs, and they're trying. We're less far ahead than we are with electricity generation, but for example, you know, you can actually grow algae, or algae, I'm never sure how to say that word, you know, pond scum. In vats. It'll double its mass every 24 hours. You just have to supply it with, you can use salt water or waste water. It doesn't have to be clean water you want for other purposes. You don't have to use farmland. You put it in vats, and that stuff will produce huge masses of biomass, which you then crush, and you get something like 40 to 70% of it by weight is actually oil, equivalent to biodiesel. You know, so, you know, you could put the Middle East out of business in terms of oil exporting in 15 years if you put your mind to it. You want energy independence and you want to solve the climate change problem. That's a one solution fits all kind of step. So, you know, this is doable stuff. It's not that we have to reinvent the wheel here. We have the wheel. But we've left it very late. I mean, Mr. Bush and his friends have wasted 8 years, essentially, that we could have. So now we have to do it as a crash program, not as a gentle, gradual approach, because the time's running out. You mustn't go past 2 degrees hotter. Somewhere just a little bit north of there, you hit the feedbacks. You trigger natural processes that begin to accelerate the warming, and you lose control. You can't stop it just by cutting your own emissions anymore. And you can't get at the natural emissions. You can't refreeze the permafrost or cool the surface of the ocean. Once they start emitting greenhouse gases too, it's good night, nurse, and you're heading for 5 or 6 degrees hotter, which frankly is not a planet that would support even 1 billion human beings, and most of it's howling desert or flooded.
And do you think there's political will of, say, in Canada, for example?
No, actually, Canada is one of the few industrial countries where there clearly isn't political will, and I don't just blame the present government for that. The Liberals and the Conservatives between them had about 10 years, well, actually 15 years since the signature, 11 years since the signature of the Kyoto Accord. Most industrial countries that signed the Kyoto Accord signed up to very modest cuts in their emissions, like 5% below 1990 level. Which meant they had to get back down from where they were in 97, but still, you know, you had quite a while to do it. And most of them have actually done it. I mean, even the Americans who didn't sign have not grown their emissions since 1997. Canada is 35% above its target. I mean, and we're the only one. I mean, we are the rogue state. And, you know, that is... 9 years of the Liberals paying no attention to the commitments they'd made, followed by 2 or 3 years of Stephen Harper and the Conservatives, who don't even really believe that those commitments should be honored. And here we are, the outlier. But in most countries, the governments are a little better focused on this, and except, of course, the U.S. until Bush goes away. But I think everything Obama says suggests he will be focused. The Americans are way ahead of us on this, even despite Mr. Bush.
Hey, you've traveled quite a bit on this tour already for this book. What's the reaction been to your message?
Well, it upsets people, because in a way, when you do these scenarios, you begin to make it real. You know, it's no longer just numbers. It's going to be 2 degrees hotter, and that will be bad. It's no longer statistics. When you start doing the scenarios, even if the scenarios aren't right in every detail, and I'm sure they're not, because the future's not fully predictable. If it was, I wouldn't have to work as a journalist. I'd be selling my predictions for large sums of money to governments. You know,
right, but, right.
But even if some of the details are wrong, when you look at the scenarios, you begin to think, oh my God, of course that's the implication of 2 degrees hotter or 1 degree hotter. How could it be otherwise? You know, we know how people react. We're people ourselves. We can gauge. And it's going to get really ugly out there. And the part of the problem with it getting ugly, even if you're not immediately on the firing line, is that a world where countries are shutting down the borders and having disputes with their neighbors and waves of refugees and all the rest of it, failed states all over the place, is not a world that can make the kind of deals internationally we need to make to get this problem under control. The deeper you get into it, the harder it is to make the deal.
Dr. Dyer, it's been a pleasure having you on again. This is an urgent and necessary book. Continued good luck with it.
Thank you very much.
The book is called Climate Wars. It's published by Random House Canada. $34.95 is its price. GwenDyer.com for more. Dr. Gwen Dyer on the line. I'm Joseph Plata.